Welcome to Combo Heals, the transformative mental health podcast.
We're three remarkable women from diverse backgrounds.
Join forces to harness the incredible healing power of conversation.
Each season, we embark on a journey
of exploration, empathy, and shared experiences
to illuminate the profound impact that thoughtful dialogue can have on our lives.
This is the podcast, The Convo Heals. We're in season one. We're focusing on parenting this season. We are learning together, talking together about how to be whole parents. And this is the episode I want to say I have been most looking forward to this convo with the two of you. We are talking about joy today. Thank you so much for being here and for being part of our conversation. We hope as you're listening and taking the information in, this might lead to convos in your real life with friends, family, your partner, your children. But also, please talk to us, interact with us. We'd love to hear what you're thinking and what you're making of the conversations that we're just getting started here. So as in every episode, we're going to give you the science, the wisdom, the practice on the topic to consider, because there's lots of ways to think about wholeness and wellness in our lives. As always, we begin with the science. The science on joy is something I have been just immersed in over the last few years of my career. I began my career thinking a lot about children's development in contexts of risk, trauma, stress, and what families do, what parents do to help their children be well despite these contexts of risk. And I was really, really fortunate to have wonderful colleagues who, through many, many conversations over the years, really together we started thinking a lot more about the conceptual, not just the lived, but the conceptual idea of joy. So that's what I want to talk about here in the moment on science. What do scientists think of when we talk about joy? So the research on joy is very limited. We've said in other episodes, researchers have largely learned about human emotions by studying fear. And secondary to that tends to be sadness, anger, frustration. For lots of reasons, partly it's a methodological problem. How do you inspire joy, for example, in a lab setting? But also, we're a society obsessed with control and with learning how to control our emotions that we too routinely define as emotions are negative.
And perceiving emotions as the problem.
As the problem.
And needs to get fixed.
Right. So I want to actually step back from joy, I promise, just a second. I'm promising my colleagues here because I get...
Are we good, Dr. Ravo?
Are we good?
She can contain her joy herself.
We're bursting with joy. We're falling out of our chairs. Also, I have a tendency to just really wonk out on the data and the research, so you'll pull me back in. But I want to do just a couple of sentences on, like, first of all, what do we even mean by emotions? I know you hear that word and you're like, I know what that is. It's like feelings, right? Or does anybody else start singing the Bee Gees song in their head? Covered by Destiny's Child.
Which one? What?
Oh, yeah. I love
just emotions.
You better sing, boo.
Over. Heartache to heartache, lost in the song. But if you don't come back, come back to me, baby. Darling.
Something like
it's
that.
It's coming back to you.
Something like that.
No one else. Just thank you. Thank you. So emotions. What are emotions? So I heard a great analogy recently I want to bring to you. I just want to say this is not mine. I read this in a research article. I'm so sorry. I can't remember the name of the gentleman who wrote it. We'll write it in the show notes. Emotions are like photosynthesis.
Okay.
So often we hear that word and we think emotions are the thing I feel, or it's the information from the environment. It's the signal. It's the trigger. It's the experience. It's a state of being. Like photosynthesis, it is a system level trait. And here's what that means. Let me walk you through photosynthesis for a minute. Plant people, I hope I get this right. This is not my area. But the plant grows in the soil, roots down the soil, stem shoots above the ground, feels the sun's rays, takes in the carbon dioxide we breathe out. These things together, the plant takes those forces in and generates oxygen. And the roots grow and the plant grows. And all of these things are happening as one system. And that is the process of photosynthesis. Okay. So human emotions are not any one thing. Human emotions are the product, the process, the state is one way to think of it, but emotions are what we call a very complicated set of processes in play. So to make it more simpler, when you feel sad, sometimes that is because something in the environment is cueing you in some way. But what's kind of happening undercover at a level that may not even be conscious of is that there are these there's this tiny dance happening. Your brain and different regions in your brain are starting to talk to one another through hormonal secretions, little messengers. They start talking to each other. They're talking to your body and telling your body to kind of, you know, wake up, attend, move around. You're responding to that behaviorally. And so you're making small shifts and adjustments in response to all of this happening. It's very dynamic back and forth. And then what sort of becomes at your level of consciousness, awareness, after all of that is in motion, is I am sad. Sometimes there isn't an obvious thing making you sad. Sometimes you're mistaking what's happening. Sometimes you're hungry, or you're actually angry, or you're tired. Tired is one we often confuse with sadness. But because there are all these dynamic processes happening that create the sense that we are sad, there's lots of places for miscommunication to happen, especially in this world where we are so tuned out all the time. From all of those micro-level processes happening. So one of the things about emotions in general is that we've named a set of them, sadness, anger, fear, joy. But those are just things that we've sort of agreed upon, are reasonably universal in terms of how we both experience them, and then sort of community by community, we have shared rules for how we express them to one another. Who gets to express what? Anger is a good example of that. Based on how much power you have in a society, the more anger you're allowed to express. There's a hidden curriculum around that emotion. But there's also all these other emotional experiences we just never name because they're small. We maybe aren't tuned into them. We mistake them for other things. So if we want to get really simple about it, what I really like to think of as emotions, I like to talk about emotional information. And how do we use whatever level of awareness we have, right? So if your first level of awareness that something is happening is that you say to yourself, I'm angry, I'm sad, I'm disappointed. How do we use that as information and make that the moment that we talk back to the environment or check in with ourselves and say, okay, well, what is happening? How is that useful information for me instead of just learning to suppress it? But one of the reasons that we have so many tools to suppress deep breathing, distraction, is because most of us are really not aware of what we feel until we're being flooded. We've been ignoring it. And your body's like, hey, things are happening. I need you to hear me and adjust. And it will knock on your face if it has to. And at that point, sometimes all you can do, because then it's a lot of noise, is disconnect, take a break, sort things out. But what if we could start really tuning in to those smaller, quieter, conversations happening within and all around. And the reason I really liken this to photosynthesis is because it's easy to understand a plant as part of the ecosystem. The roots are in the soil. It's relying on the sun. And the plant leans in more to the sun, not away. And so we do want to lean in to the emotional information we're getting, not always disconnect, not always assume we're being flooded. Because the more we lean in, the healthier we grow. We are rooted in the ecosystem, just like every other living thing. Okay.
Brilliant.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Here's why I want to make that the context. This is very important to me. I want to talk about joy, the most understudied emotion there is, and why it matters so much, why we need to talk about it. It is one of those things we don't tune into.
Yeah.
We don't feel the right to tune into. We sort of don't understand what to do with it, maybe, why it matters. So I want to talk about joy. I also really want us to have a great conversation about Black joy, which is starting to cross over from the popular conversation, from being sort of a cultural wisdom, a cultural discourse, into the scientific literature. But I'm going to save it. Let's talk about it in the wisdom section. Does that work, do you think?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's start, but it's different than joy. I want to say that. But let's talk about joy. Think about joy like honey. This is scientifically what joy is. It's sticky. We know that joy, first of all, is the first emotion that we can detect babies expressing in an organized way. So it appears to develop really early. And we have to believe it's very meaningful. Because as we've talked about in previous episodes, children, young children, only do things with meaning. They haven't yet learned that we do things performatively. So joy develops really early, and it's sticky. The goal of joy, the purpose of joy, the meaning of joy is to bond people together. And joy is the greatest resource for making learning stick. The ways that we master new skills, the ways that we even remember facts and data and content is through joy. Joy maximizes the degree to which we can do that. There's this great theory by a researcher named Barbara Fredrickson called the Broaden and Build Theory. And it emphasizes the ways that joy is how we both broaden our skill sets and build on them. Keep going, keep experiencing more mastery, more wisdom. And joy, therefore, but joy is like lost in a lot of our learning environments. It's thought of as an added thing when it's possible. And we often think we can just plug it in, right? When I talk about joy with parents, when we start brainstorming, we tend to think about add-ons like Saturday night dance party. And what I really want to emphasize in today's conversation is how meaningful joy is to our very existence, to doing all the things that are the most human, relating, innovating, creating, evolving. We need joy to do all of those things. So why have we lost it? How do we get it back? Why do we seem to not care enough about it, talk enough about it? But from a scientific perspective, joy is perhaps the most important human emotion and maybe the one that we have the most capacity to really cultivate, to really dance with.
Can you describe the distinction, the difference, the similarities between what we have come to understand as happiness and joy? Are they the same? Are they different?
Yes. Thank you so much. So joy is, I think of joy as from the soul. It can be a lot of other things. It can be peace. It can be vigor, exuberance. It can be grief, even. So Jewish people have a ritual called sitting Shiva. After someone dies, The community gathers in the home of the family members of the deceased person or in the deceased person's home. And a lay person from the community, not a clergy person, conducts a religious service, because the idea is that we're caring for each other.
Right.
There's always food. And there's a part in the service where you tell stories.
Yes.
And the funnier, the better. So I lead these services for my community. And one of my favorites was the story about the time that Bobby set the house on fire while she was cooking Shabbat and the matzo ball soup. And she walked away and the house caught on fire. And people were roaring with laughter and crying at the same time because they miss her. And they were telling this hilarious story. And that's joy, right, in grief. Yeah. Joy, and that's why I say it's like honey. If you think about joy as the sticky stuff. It's the feeling of being deeply rooted, deeply connected to self, to history, to others, to the world around you, to the experience.
Yeah. It's aliveness.
It's aliveness. Yeah. Yes. I like that.
I know Esther Perel's work is more in the arena of relationship and romance and sex and intimacy, but she just talks about, I love her too. Mm-hmm. Look her up, y'all. But she talks a lot about eroticism as not just sexual or sensual, but like an awake and an openness and aliveness in the world, a vibrance, a vitality. And I feel like that's the distinction between joy, where happiness is, conceptually speaking, I'm not completely talking scientifically, socially and conceptually, is very, it wavers and it's usually conflated with pleasure, like we talked about before.
Yes.
Joy more of as a state of existence.
And I think people associate happiness with the absence of what we call negative emotions, right? You can't be happy if you're feeling angry about something or nervous or sad or grieving, right? Versus joy, it doesn't work that way. It can't coexist with all. And it moves all. It brings it together. I think it helps you understand. It helps it somehow, I think, maybe marinate in meaningful ways.
I also think we can say that joy is the experience of full humanity. And I wonder if that moves us into the wisdom on this topic.
Yeah, the wisdom. I have to say, this was one of the topics I was most looking forward to as well. And just listening to the two of you talk, you know, the wisdom, as a reminder to our viewers, is really the soundness of what we've inherited culturally, racially, regionally, socially, and how much richness comes from that arena of knowledge as well. And I'm kind of sitting culturally with a couple of things that, you know, there is a term that we've thrown around quite a bit around the strong Black woman syndrome and the invincible Black woman schema. And I won't go too deeply into that, but it's kind of, in a nutshell, this idea, it's really a threatening and a wiping away of the range of humanity that exist in the Black experience. And it's like you've got to be almost stoic and strength is only conceptualized through that, like, that stoic posture. And I think one of the greatest consequences of that is it seems to be, at least historically speaking, most anchored in the doing, the achieving, and the holding of it all together. It's excessively responsible. And we tend to talk about it as a discrediting of sorrow and sadness and anger and fear. But it also really compromises the way we hold joy, too. And nobody ever really talks about that side of it. It's almost like, you know, not as revered or something. And even communally, you know, I love the kind of hashtags you see, Black Boy Joy. And, you know, I appreciate that because I was sharing this story with you. I remember being at the pool with my children. And this is probably more an expression of fun, but I think the state of existence was a joyful existence. My kids felt so free and they felt so comfortable and so safe and so just just free. And they were just screaming and yelling and jumping in the pool. And I was like, shh. I was really like, be quiet, calm down, because the implicit messages that I inherited was there's no room for you, period. Not your sadness, not your anger, not even your joy. Your joy is disruptive.
As Black boys.
Yes. Mm. And girls. You got to be polite, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, it's
and quiet
and know your place. Mm-hmm. So that's that side of it. Yes. As a result of the kind of marginalized element of the culture. But my inheritance, though.
Yeah.
I love the story you said about how we honor life in a moment where we're kind of entangled in death. So like funerals are really, you know, celebrations of life. They're fun. Yes. And togetherness is so, there's ritualistic elements to it, like ritual.
Yes.
But then there's also freedom in it.
Yes.
It doesn't, who knows what time the party started and who knows what time the party ends. Like there's no metric or parameter for it really.
Mm.
And you see that in a lot of ritualistic ways in my culture. And in my upbringing. So joy for me is not only an emotion. It is truly a state of existence, a state of being, a declarative communing and connectedness to my aliveness.
I'm having this moment of as you're like hearing you talk and feeling your energy, thinking for me, joy is being baptized in all of God's blessings.
Mm.
And all the richness of it, you know? Yeah, so even with the grief and the passing, but it's like when I feel really connected to things that are godly given. Mm. So nature comes to mind, right? Mm. Human connections come to mind, laughter, holding that hug. I was thinking about my, you know, past brother, and that even though he's not here, right? All the ways that I feel that connection.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, like it has, and I work really hard consciously to make that my day-to-day experiences where I want to feel like I am connected to God's blessings and not losing sight of it, right? So it's like even when I'm driving, like looking at like the big, what's in front of me, you know, we just had this like really beautiful a snowstorm in Michigan, right? And it was just so, so gorgeous looking at the trees, like things like that. But it's like, it's intentional to want to receive. So you have to want to receive the joy. As I'm talking out loud, I'm connecting to that piece of like the, like feeling, your heart has to be open to it. And so maybe that's what can be, it can be hard when it comes to parenting because we can't give our children what we cannot give ourselves. I really, to some extent, believe that, right? So when we close our heart to the right to experience joy, how is that socialized to the child?
I can't help but just remember our episode 2, I think it was, around trauma and just how that the part of you that's describing our kind of the shared accountability of all of this, like the accountability of the universe and the and God and the world and this kind of spiritual domain of life, whatever you call that.
Yeah.
But then also our shared accountability to be open to it, connect to it, engage in it, and how I, as a psychologist, what has been a barrier, not an impossible feat, but a barrier has been the way in which traumatized experiences can really skew vision and make us kind of reluctant to embrace or even believe that joy is accessible to me, even when my current experience does not feel pleasurable. And that's why I love the examples of the funeral. You know, I've had some of the most fun at funerals, you know, and some of the, and you talk about the sticky nature of it. My one of my grandfather's funerals what is most palpable in my body is a cousin, I hope you ain't watching this, a cousin trying to sing, and he should not have been singing, but he was just living his best life singing.
Are you talking about me a minute ago?
It's not you. And he was singing, and sure, maybe he couldn't really carry the tune.
Yeah.
But what he did is he held, he was the one of the anchors of joy.
Yes.
And me and my brother are kind of cracking up, yes, laughing. And I can feel it in my body right now.
Yes.
It'll live in me forever. Yes. So that accessibility in even the smallest things or even the darkest places.
Yes.
I love that you're talking about that.
And I think all the shoulds block joy.
Right.
So I think the more a person is living or a parent is living with, it should be this way. Thinking, I don't know why I'm thinking about family pictures. Maybe because, you know, yesterday was my birthday and we're trying to take family pictures, right? But like, parents get really stressed out.
Right.
Oh, we should be looking at the camera in this way. We should be dressed in this way. And you know, something happened yesterday that made me feel really proud of my mom. And thinking again about the cultural things and how your environment really can make it easier for you to access joy. And I really am having this moment right now of that the shoulds really do block, get in the way. People were starting to show up and she made a comment about what my daughter was wearing. And she said, I'm trying to get her, you know, get her to change. She has stains on her shirt and like, please get her to change. And I had a conversation with Arya. I said, Arya, when there is a celebration, some people really like to put on like their best outfit and be really clean. And that's important for them. And some people don't really care about what they're wearing. And you get to decide, right? You get to decide what you want to do. And I think if we had been living in Iran in that culture, it would have been the should would have gotten really sticky for my mom.
Mm-hmm.
And she would have not been able to, see past it. But that's not what happened, right? And it's a sign of growth in many ways, but it's, again, a sign of, like, freedom in many ways. And because pictures and capturing moments is really special for her. Mm-hmm. She likes to be able to look back, right? And so, yeah, she, of course, my daughter chose to not change her clothes. Those pictures were such a joyful moment. There was so much playfulness. Mm-hmm. And I think about the families that get so stressed out about how something should be.
Mm-hmm.
I'll also add that joy is so much about, for me, connecting to, and we're all saying this, connecting to our people and connecting our children back to our people.
Mm-hmm.
And it has really become a practice for me to find joy as intimacy, as connection, as realness in all the moments. That's where I go.
Mm-hmm.
In all the moments, there's joy because joy is what binds us, right? What makes this life our life and our life together.
But I think that's because you work really hard to not separate work from life. You bring life into work and work into life. For you, it's all...
I work really hard at that now, but I think just... what has been an undercurrent for me as a Jewish person is that there's always suffering.
Mm-hmm.
That's what life, that is life. There isn't, in some ways, like a lot of energy around feeling pushed back by it. It's more like, here's the suffering.
It's just, it's a part of this.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It is an expected part of this. I mean,
and there's a balance, like always in the suffering, there's connection, there's godliness in all the moments. That's the joy.
So
there's always a way to celebrate. There's always a song to sing. Mm.
So tell us about some of the ways that you practice this when it comes to parenting.
Yes. Practical joy. So let's move into the practice. Mm-hmm. I want to say that just in case folks are jumping around in the podcast and you want to join us at the level of practice. There's one thing that's coming to mind based on what we were just talking about. What I was just thinking about is the way joy is the practice of being soul to soul or soul to universe, that it's the moments when I am most here. Oh, I actually just wrote an article for a Jewish parenting magazine called Keveler about this phrase, hineni, in Hebrew. It's said a couple of times in the Torah. It's an expression of presence. Here I am. I am here. There's no exact English translation because it's something more than here I am. It's like the full human commitment to the moment, to the presence, and to God and my relationship to God, and whatever comes next, I don't have to know. Right? It's that faith. It's that, as you said, it's that vitality and aliveness. And so how do I cultivate that in my kids? Well, the first thing is I am a good role model of that. I sing all the time. I ask them to tell me about the thoughts in their head and not just what they did all day. When they tell me, I'm curious. I wonder. I was actually telling a friend yesterday that I know for a lot of parents, this thing I'm going to describe next is a challenge. I have a teenage boy, almost teenage boy, who's very interested in sports. And I've never been accused of being athletic, you guys. sports ball, various versions of sports ball only hold my attention for so long. And really only if one of my babies is on the court field, whatever. And he loves to tell me all the details about the sports ball activities in the world. And I know I've talked to other moms who are like, oh, my God, I know all the stats of the whatever and the whatever, and it's mind-numbing. And I'm like, well, then stop talking about it. What a terrible experience for both of you. That's not a relationship. But
where you're tolerating.
Yeah, he doesn't want that. You don't want that. That's not, that's not love. That's not joy. That's not presence, even if it looks like presence. So for me, it's about finding myself in that conversation. So I say things like, I can't, you're telling me some numbers here, and you know me in numbers, but tell me a story about one of these players. Who's the underdog? And then he tells me a story. And now we're in the moment together. So some of it is truly, it's about the convo. It's about the small convos where I'm really saying with intention, I want to know you and I want you to know me.
There's room for the both of us.
There's room for the both of us. That's the everyday practice of joy.
I'm going to add something to what you're saying, because I think a lot of women and moms don't feel empowered. They don't have this ability of giving consent around experiences, whether it is your kids touching you all over, right? Like, or like, she can't give herself the consent to say, I'm not interested in the, to engage in the conversation in this way, right? And I think that's an important practice for parents, but in particular mothers, to feel worthy enough of really openly saying to their kid, I'm not going to consent. I don't give consent to this, or that doesn't feel good for my body.
Or just know.
Or yes, or to know. And because I think it makes, it's another barrier to being able to access joy. The lack of skill, the lack of ability to know what works for you and what doesn't work for you, and to communicate it without shame and not feel like you are being selfish. And that you have to be completely selfless. So I think that's an important part of practicing joy as a parent with your children.
I can't express something that has been a part of my experience for a very long time. And that is that, you know, the, you're talking about shame, but I love sitting with people that kind of can hold joy from a stature in life in a similar way to me, because mm-hmm. I've been criticized for it a lot mm-hmm. in my personal life. Mm-hmm. And I think what's true is that there's also a part of me that has been conditioned in ways to kind of disconnect emotionally and repress and suppress hard emotion. That mm-hmm. is true. I recognize and own that as a part of my experience. But there is also a big part of me that lives in joy that is ever present. And I like that about me. Mm-hmm. And I've talked about this in therapy before, where I'm like, should I feel worse? Mm-hmm. Everybody's making me feel like I should feel worse mm-hmm. about this thing. Mm-hmm. And I am disappointed and I am a little sad, but I'll be fine. Like, life is good. I like my life. I mean, it's kind of mm-hmm. happening for me right now. Mm-hmm. I'm going through some really hard things mm-hmm. that on Tuesday may make me cry, but on Friday I'm kind of grateful for. Mm-hmm. And in both of those experiences, I feel really, I do have joy. And I think that sometimes there is kind of this questioning mm-hmm. of that. And I think it's connected to what we've already been talking about this, like, almost belief system that it's not accessible to me. Mm-hmm. Like, is it accessible to me? And I can imagine there's a lot of people watching that might have a really hard time with the sentiment that joy is everywhere. Mm. How is that possible when mm. my mother is dying and my child has an illness and my finances are plummeting and I just lost my job? And we're not here to dismiss mm-hmm. the fact that there's a hardness and an intensity of discomfort yeah. and mm-hmm. and grief, yeah. but that how liberating it is to know that there's yes. something in it of value for me. Mm. And I wouldn't want to live life any other way. And I think the way it looks with my children is my growing comfortability naming that. Mm. And, you know, sometimes my son will, because again, it's true that sometimes I can also be disconnected. You know, I'm well taught at compartmentalization. So there's no perfection here or absolute here. But sometimes my oldest son will say, "Mommy, why does your voice sound like that?" Mm. And I'll say, "What do you mean? I think you're tired today." I'll be like, "Oh, you're right. I am a little tired." And then he'll say, "I think you need a rest. I think you need," and I say, "Oh, I think you're right." So in this moment where we're conversing, there's room for all of us. Mm-hmm. In this moment, I'm not, you know, putting it all together for mm-hmm. my child. I'm saying, "Man, I am kind of tired, honey. I do need a little bit of rest. But you know, I had a great day. I had such a, like, I did this and I did this, or this happened or this happened." And I think what I'm trying to magnify here as a practice is the naming and the holding of all of the nuances of the experience mm-hmm. and not like hoarding it, you know. So my child is noticing something that might look like a conflict with joy. Yeah. And I get to be someone that expresses gratitude that he noticed me. Yes. I get to then validate the discomfort that I feel. And then I get to also acknowledge the fact mm-hmm. that I'm still okay.
Yes. I'm so glad that you told that story. Okay. Because this really brings us back full circle to something I was trying to name in the section on science and I think having a hard time articulating as well. So there's this thing that's happening in us all the time as we're in the world, rooted in the ecosystem, that there's this dialogue going on all the time between parts of our brain and our body and the experience, and we are reacting and informing the conversation. And a lot of it is not at the level of consciousness for us right. until things get hot. Right. And so my clients, when I sort of introduce this idea to them, always say back to me, "But like, what am I supposed to do about that?" Hmm. Because it's true that you can't self-monitor every tiny shift and breeze that blows by. Right. And I often end up giving them something that is unsatisfying, because what is true is that it isn't about self-monitoring. It's like the more you lean in to joy, the stickiness between you and everything else, the more that awareness is just there. It just shows up. And this is a really great example that we are never having just one emotion. This is backed up by all the science, if that's what you need, that there's just all this communication and information coming in and out. And you were having lots of experiences.
Right.
You were maybe at a level of consciousness focused on the great day that you had had. But you're connected to your world. So there was another person in your world who was engaging in that dialogue and noticing signals and drawing it out of you so that you could rest. And that's what it's all about, is like, you can't think of joy as a thing. It's a practice. It's a system level state, trait, however you kind of think about the language around it. How are we living lives that are joyful? And to me, it's about always trying to be connected, rooted, as much as I absolutely can.
It's a choice.
I know we're done-ish. What do you think about, like, the stickiness within me and between us? One of the things that I've described, and I'm curious to know what y'all think about this in a practical sense, with clientele or people that are experiencing a lot of depressiveness is that language. Like, what is sticky within you and what is sticky between you and around you? Because the information element of it, like, there's nothing to fear here. Maybe there's something to learn here about how I'm disaligned or disconnected or unaware. And I think that feels a part of this too.
Or why is my brain and body overcorrecting for me?
There you go. Yeah, I love that.
What has become too much?
I'm working hard on not going on a whole tangent about what depression I think is.
Right. Next episode. Another episode.
Another
bonus episode.
I want to hear it.
I think it's very necessary. We'll I would love to do that.
Yes. Another episode.
And anxiety.
Yes. So a last thing I'll share for joy for folks who are really just finding themselves in this concept that's new for you. Joy is cultivated in rituals. Rituals are routine, predictable events that also are infused by some amount of identity. So it doesn't have to be lofty. It doesn't have to be like our family ritual is, you know, serving at the soup kitchen on Sundays, although that's a great ritual. It can also be Taco Tuesday because we all love tacos, or Spaghetti Monday because we think spaghetti is funny. It's got to have some element of we. But it should be simply a predictable event that shapes that. And I encourage families to have a daily ritual, a weekly ritual, and an annual blowout ritual. Everybody should have a part that is predictable to them. Setting the table, coming up with a menu, decorating, etc. And it has to be something that isn't that. One person often gets it going, but the point of a ritual over time is that it just exists as joyful space, and that everybody knows it's this night, this time, this place. And even if somebody is not well or feeling a little depressed or doesn't have the energy, the ritual can still go on. A good example of a daily ritual is something you say to one another before you leave the house, a song you sing in your kitchen. A good weekly ritual often tends to be family mealtime, but if that's not available to you, it can be lots of other things. Annual rituals often center on holidays. But one of the problems with that tends to be the expectations from the world around us. So that so those rituals are great, but I really encourage you to build on that. My family has this very ridiculous ritual I'll share with you. It's always the Saturday after, I believe, Hanukkah ends. My now 8-year-old came up with this. It's called Move Corn, you guys. She invented a holiday called Move Corn. It's exactly what it sounds like. We watch movies all day and eat popcorn. I mean, This is not complicated. It's not sophisticated. Yeah. But we all love popcorn and movies and each other.
Yes.
So we have this annual ritual, and it's ours. And we've been building on it over the years. I get matching pajamas for us. We put sprinkles on the popcorn. So I really encourage you to get inventive and find one for yourselves. Do you all have a ritual you want to share before we go, or are we out of time today?
I love this, the that some are grand and some are simple. This feels like a joyous ritual, and that just ignites that Black boy joy in my home. Please. I mean, I have every day. They say it for me every day. No matter what age they are, you're my favorite 8-year-old, you're my favorite 11-year-old. Mm. And then as they age, you're my favorite 12-year-old, you're my favorite 9-year-old. So I'll be like, you know what? Guess what? I'm your favorite 8-year-old. Yeah. You know, I'm your favorite.
Love that. Yeah.
So, yeah. Yesterday I said to my son, I said, you know, you're my favorite. He's like, I know, I'm your favorite 11-year-old. And you know, you're my favorite 41. And I was like, why do you got to emphasize, you know? But yeah, that's our language. Mm.
That is such an important one. I love it so much. You belong here with me.
Yes. For me, what comes to mind is around hard moments when my kids are having hard feelings, whether they are sad because I have to go to work, or they've fallen down and gotten hurt, or they're upset, or they're sick. I hold them and I rub their back and I say, I keep you warm, I keep you safe. Mm-hmm. And it's what they expect is something that happens. And then they will at times will come back and say, I keep you warm, I keep you safe.
Yeah.
Yes. That is the magic when they carry the rituals forward.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When my kids get out of the car for school in the morning, I like to say, be you, shine your light. And my husband says to them, don't be a punk.
I love that.
And we laugh. And but also those, do both of those things, you guys, when you go in the world. Yeah. They know. They know. So those are some of our family rituals. We hope you all will start your own, continue your own. Think about rituals that exist in your family, things maybe your grandma did, your bubby did, if your family has not proceeded in that way, talk to your best friend, ask what kind of family rituals exist. And if you don't have any that are easily accessible, start your own.
Create some.
Yes, create them. Create your family from now. Yeah. Let that joy flow through the generations. And we'd love to hear about what you come up with. So please reach out. Tell us all about it. Be part of the conversation, the healing conversation. And that's all for us today, talking about joy. That's all for us for now, talking about joy. We're always talking about joy. And we'll see you next time. Thanks for being here.
The convo doesn't stop here. For links to the resources and research mentioned in today's episode, head on over to the show notes at convohills.com/4. That's convohills.com/4.